black thing go from left to right, and I thought, I'm going to die out here. No one's ever going to know.
And I couldn't believe what my eyeballs were showing me. I'll never forget how evil the eyes were. It was horrible. I mean, I've never seen nothing that evil.
It ran towards me at a rate that I can't even explain. Turned and stared at me. And this look of, I just want to kill you. I want to say it was human, but it wasn't.
He was yelling at me to grab a gun, grab a gun. I was like, for what? He said, just grab a gun. And there's footprints all the way to the door of my house. It had went inside my garage all the way to the door.
911, what are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better... Sir? See ya.
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
You're listening to Sasquatch Chronicles. Check us out online at sasquatchchronicles.com. If you've had an encounter, email me. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com.
I'd stop by when I'd go by there, if Roger was there, say hello to him, and he'd say, let me put my horse in the truck with you, and we'll go up and I'll ride with you. And I said, well, sure, come on. So, you know, around campfires at night, he'd play these little cassettes, you know, in his recorder, his battery-powered recorder, about different testimonials that people had talked to him about, and then he'd show me a plaster cast, and say, you know, this is a Bigfoot. Roger talked to me about it, and I said, well, Roger, you know, I'm kind of like old Harry Truman. I have to see things to believe it. I'd never even heard the word Sasquatch before, you know, and I hadn't heard anything about Bigfoot either. I don't remember exactly what day it was that Roger come in my driveway. Big eyes wide open. Bob, he said, we got to go to Northern California. He said they found three different size of footprints around a piece of equipment that they put in there on a Friday evening before the Labor Day weekend. And then they come back on Tuesday to go to work, and these footprints are all around this piece of equipment. And we went down there. Well, road, miles and miles and miles and miles. My intent was to be able to see footprints in the soil when I went down there. That's what I really wanted to see, was footprints, evidence. Well, it had rained all the way down, up and down the West Coast. So when we got there, you could see where there was things in the dirt, but they weren't what you'd call identifiable footprints that you could put a product in there and come out with a plaster, good plaster cast. So I was pretty disappointed about the whole trip right from the get-go. So then we just rode. We covered miles and miles and miles every day, and nothing. I just was not that all happy about the whole thing, because start with, it was my truck, my expense, and Roger's brother-in-law was supposed to reimburse me for all of the expense going down there, because I guess he believed in Roger actually more than I did. Well, we were only about 3.5-4 miles away from where we camped, and we come around up the creek bed, we come around this big downfall tree, and that's when the creature was standing by the creek. I just turned the pack horse loose because he was jerking and pulling on me, and I wanted to handle the horse I was setting on, because Roger was probably 20 feet in front of me, and he was having a hard time with his horse, and he was getting off and grabbing his camera on the saddlebag, you know. So I got to the point where I said, well, Roger's having problems with his horse to hold him and control him. And as quick as he got off, then he started to cross the creek. Well, I was just there sitting on a horse trying to control my horse, or was controlling my horse, watching him. When he got up to relocate, then he said to me, Bob, can you cover me? Because he was trying to get closer. He got up and ran at a kind of at an angle at where the creature was going up through the opening there, and he was trying to get a little closer. So that's when I rode across the creek and got off. And here's this great huge muscle creature, you know. And so when I went across the creek and got off the horse, I knew if it came back that I could not get a shot at it sitting on the horse and it jumping around. So that's why I got off the horse and just stood there. Well, I thought, oh, God, they really do exist. When I first saw the film, two or three days after, or a couple days afterwards, I didn't think the film was that good. And then when the ridicule started, then I thought, well, I don't like it, but I can handle it. And so I just kind of let it, like, water off a duck, you know. Not really. It bothered me a lot. Bothered me a lot about a lot of this stuff, you know, and it still does. One time I was asked, Bob, would you do it again if you had an opportunity to go back down there? And I said, no way. I wouldn't even think about going back down there again. The thing is, there's been so many good people that I've met after all the ridicule, at the conventions that I've gone to, and people that have actually had sightings and had, you know, had encounters with them and evidence. Then I'm just, I feel like every time I talk to somebody, it's just a little more of a weight lifted off me. Of all the money that Roger and Al made, you can't buy the friends that I have acquired over the years. So I figure that I'm much richer than they are, and it isn't with money. I'm a happy man. I don't have nothing to hide, or my conscience is clear.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. That was from episode 90 when I interviewed Bob. And I know I talked about this show on Friday night and Saturday night. And I thought what I'd do is just do a little tribute to Bob, maybe talk to him about his life. I know we covered the Patterson-Gimlin film. And with the 50-year anniversary coming up, Bob will be at the International Bigfoot Conference. It's in Kennewick, Washington, September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And more than just Bob, there's a lot of speakers there, and Russell Acord puts on a great conference. If you get a chance, I highly recommend going to that conference. But tonight, what I thought I'd do is just talk to Bob about his life and talk about what he's, you know, beyond the Patterson-Gimlin film. Get to know Bob a little bit more for the audience out there. If you've had an encounter and you'd like to be on the show, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. And let's jump into it tonight. I want to welcome Russell Acord and Bob Gimlin to the show. How are you guys?
Doing great. Hey, doing real good, Wes. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you guys. And I know I want to get into the International Bigfoot Conference. And for the audience, they can go to the internationalbigfootconference.com, get your tickets. If you go to sasquatchchronicles.com, there's a link there for you to purchase your tickets, and I recommend it. It's a great venue. It's a great conference that Russell puts on. Bob will be there. Everyone loves to see Bob, and I really appreciate you guys coming on. I wanted to ask you, Bob, a couple questions. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, and I've always wondered if you've ever thought about this. With regard to Roger Patterson, how do you think he would feel if he was alive today to see the interest in your guys' film? Because I know there was a lot of heartache and a lot of it was a pain. And I know when I had you on the show, you went through a lot of heartache with the film and you regretted it. And, you know, I'm sure that if Roger would have lived long enough,
he would have gone through that same thing. But you knew the man really well, Bob. How do you think he would have thought today? What do you think his thoughts would have been today with regard to how people are looking at the film now?
Well, thank you for asking that, Wes, because I think about it frequently, about wish Roger was still alive. You know, if Roger knew the magnitude of what's going on in this modern day, he would have had a smile. He wouldn't have quit smiling. Roger would have said, thank you, folks, because he put his heart and soul into that. What hours that I was able to be around Roger. And I'll tell you what, if he knew the magnitude of today, of what's going on with people like Russell putting on conferences and the different ones that put on these conferences, and the interest alone that I just get from different people from conferences and by mail alone, Roger would be a very, very happy man. And I hope wherever he's at that he is a very happy man.
Yeah, I appreciate the answer. I've always wondered that. You know, I always wondered how he would have viewed what was going on today. I know when I had you on the show, you talked about you and Roger sitting around the fire and him playing tapes of people talking about their encounters. And, you know, with the podcast like Sasquatch Chronicles and some of the others where witnesses come forward and share, you get so much information from it. And I think he would have... I think you're right. I think he would have liked that. But I'm glad you're around, Bob. I'm glad you're able to see it and go through all the all the heartache, and now you're, you know, coming out of that. And so I really appreciate it. Bigfoot aside, Bob, you want to tell us some Evel Knievel stories?
Well, yes. I'll have to say Bob Knievel, because he hadn't become Evel Knievel yet at that particular time. Well, we were racing around down at Kiona Benton and Sunnyside. You know, Bob Knievel worked for Pomeroy down there in a motorcycle shop. And where I met him was at the different races that I used to go to. Most of them were in the spring of the year, you know, when before the dust was too bad, right after we'd ride out in them sagebrush hills, cross-country races and so forth. And so... Bob Knievel came up to me one time and he said, Bob Gimlin, he said, I'm going to go daredeviling, racing and doing things. And he said, you're kind of a wild, crazy guy like me. And I said, no, I'm not as bad as you. And he said, well, anyway, he said, you and I could make a lot of money. And I said, oh, Bob, I don't think so. Because I said, there's a friend of mine here in Yakima that's kind of an amateur doing that. And I said, I'm loaning him money just to buy his groceries with. His name was Bob Keith. Anyway, and I said, besides, I got a family, and I just, and you know, Bob Knievel was quite a little bit younger than me. I was already probably 30, in my late 20s and early 30s, and Bob Knievel was probably 25, 26 years old at that time. In his prime, strong man, you know, really strong. Bob Knievel was as strong a man for his size that I ever encountered in my life. And I've run into some pretty skookum guys, you know, over the years. But he was a guy that would take a dare any time and prove that he could do it. And then when next thing I knew, he was Evel Knievel, you see, and that's when he kept on doing the things as Evel Knievel. But he picked that name up. He didn't tell me that that's what he was going to pick up, because we didn't have but just a short time to visit, you know, between races and stuff. And I wasn't a drinking man, and Bob Knievel could drink and race and still do good. Well, I knew if I drank anything, I wouldn't be able to race like he races. And so I respected him very highly. And then, of course, when he became Bob Knievel, Evel Knievel, I tried to pick up on most of the things he was doing, most
A lot of the time I didn't have that opportunity to do so, but realized that that man made more money in the first year after he was Evel Knievel, and I made the next 5 or 6 years. But I never regretted ever going with him, because he got broke up on motorcycles like I was kind of getting broke up training horses. So I respect him very highly for many different things and the challenges that he did, and most of them he beat, except if some broken bones and time in the hospital, but we just look at that as experience and education. A great guy, in my opinion, he's great. And Bobby, when Bobby was a little guy, his son, Bobby Knievel, he was out there riding these little teeny motorcycle-type things with little wheels on them and playing around with the other guys, the other kids, like the Pomeroy's kids and the ones that their dads were pretty special guys in the race business at that time. But anyway, he was a great guy, and I thought an awful lot of Bob Knievel as Evel Knievel.
Yeah, I always wondered what he was like in real life. That's not the right way to say it, but you know what I mean. What he was like in person.
Well, Wes, some people didn't like him because he seemed to be a bit arrogant. He was confident, very, very confident. And some people think that's being arrogant but he was a guy that if you challenged him for an arm wrestling contest, he'd arm wrestle and beat you. And, he was that kind of guy. He just didn't back off from nothing. And I admired a man like that because I was kind of a small sample of that myself. And so a guy like that, to me, if he was arrogant, he earned it and he was worthy of it. So what the ones that had things against Bob Knievel as he became Evel Knievel, that's their problem as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I remember watching, I realize it's a Bigfoot show, but I love talking to Bob and I love talking to you guys, Russ and Bob, and even if it's not Bigfoot related. But, you know, Evel Knievel, I kind of felt sorry for him when I watched the documentary, and this is later in life, because he always had to outdo what he just did. And I could imagine being in that position and you having this mindset, you're getting closer and closer and closer to death. And you kind of have to outdo what you just did. And so you kind of have to have a chip on your shoulder, I would imagine, to even be in a position like that. If you didn't, you probably wouldn't live very long.
Well, Wes, the way I look at it, most of these guys that are grand champions in anything they do, they have some of that. I could go right down the line and mention names of great athletes. And most of them did have a lot of that in them. And if they didn't have, they wouldn't become what they became. And the same thing with Evel Knievel. If he hadn't had that, of course, money does a lot of things to a man. And sometimes, but Bob Knievel, he would have done it if he wasn't making big money, as far as I believe that very strongly. But I'm sure the money helped a lot.
Yeah, I love that story. I've never met anyone that actually knew the man. And I like your take on him, Bob. You know, the whole arrogance thing, I can get past the arrogance. If a man's earned it, I can look past a lot of things, and arrogance is one of the things. If a man has earned it, I can put up with a guy with a chip on his shoulder, especially if he's, jumping the Grand Canyon. I can put up with a little attitude from a guy, you know what I mean?
It takes a lot of brass balls to do that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely.
By golly, I'll tell you what, I just admire somebody that says, I'm going to do it and gets it done.
Hey, Wes, I want to throw something out there. As long as I've known Bob and I've heard his stories of the things that he's done on horseback, I've told him this, and you can attest to this, I've always called Bob the cowboy version of Evel Knievel.
Yeah,
because Bob, if you've listened to the stories of his broken bones and history, that sort of thing, he's actually done it all. But when Bob was just talking just a second ago about the arrogance and the what it takes that separates somebody who's just good at it to somebody who's absolutely a champion, we had this conversation the other day. Somebody that has that arrogance, that it will take a dare, that will just step up and do anything, anytime, any place, and that's Conor McGregor. And that's one of your favorite MMA guys. He's the he's the MMA version of Evel Knievel.
He definitely is. Conor McGregor is my favorite UFC fighter, just because he is like he is, and he can prove what he is when he goes in the goes in that circle and proves it. You see, and every time I see him come in there strutting like that, I just kind of smile. I think, there comes Conor. And he knows what he can get done, and he gets it done.
Yeah,
I don't know if you guys have ever seen him when he was beat up so bad. He looked like he couldn't even get up and go, and he got up and knocked the guy out and won after he'd been beat by the kid from South America.
He's a tough boy.
Yeah,
hey, he is really.
When I was down in Vegas recently. I won't mention the UFC fighter. He's a pretty well-known. Russell knows the guy, but I had asked about the McGregor, and I'd asked, you know, is he really like that? And you know, what was interesting is the answer was yes and no. Some of it's put on for the camera, but he does have a swagger about him, and he's very quick-witted, and he's actually a very funny guy. And so, you know, you got to have some of that. I like a little swagger. I like a little chip on someone's shoulder, especially if they have the goods to back it up. And he definitely has the goods to back it up. And you're right, Russell. I mean, going back to Bob, Bob, I don't know if you want to tell this story. Again, it's not a Bigfoot story, but you told it at Beachfoot. And when you told the story, I was just like, oh, and I think I almost rebroke your shoulder when I was slapping you on the shoulder. And I hadn't heard the story yet. So that's my easy out on doing that, because I hadn't heard the story. But you had got knocked off your – go ahead and tell the story, Bob. When you had to crawl back up to the house and your wife had to – God bless her. She put towels up and gave you soup. And after like three – I think it was like 3 days, you were like, well – I figured I wasn't dead yet, so I might as well go to the hospital. Would you mind telling that story?
Well, not at all, Wes, because this big mare that the guy brought me was a Spendi mare, and he planned on getting her entered in Syracuse and the different big races, you know. And so I had her in my 60-foot round pen riding her, and she was, you know, the average guy. I'd say the average guy. I'm not trying to say that I'm not average, but anyway, the average guy would have probably just said, first time put the saddle on her, said, she's way too bronky for me. Well, you know, I'm kind of a guy that don't like to admit things like that. So I had just retired from 1 week from my job of driving truck, and I'd been riding young horses all along, but this guy brought me this big mare. And he said she's a little, she's not hard-headed, but he said she's a little tough. I said, oh, that's no problem. I think I can handle that. And I always say the fifth and the sixth ride is the ones that you really have to pay attention, because over the years of the different bronky horses that I've rode, things seem like they're going along fairly well. And that was the same case with this. Same scenario with this big mare. She seemed like she was doing fairly well. And so I was riding her in this 60-foot round pen, and on the backside and the neighbor's side, there was a lot of wild roses growing up there about 6-7 feet high. And we come around by those wild roses, and I don't know if a bird or something flew out of there and spooked her, but she lit into bucking with me, and she'd bucked some before with me, so I just threw my feet forward like I was riding a bronc right out of the chute and leaned back. And I figured, hey, big gal, give me the best shot you got, because you're not going to dump me off. And so she shot me straight out over the back. She was bucking that hard. I went out over the back, and in midair, she kicked me right in the chest with both hind feet. And I hit the ground, and I couldn't get up right away. And she come back around and ran right over. Instead of jumping over me, she walked right over my body. And I couldn't get up and walk. I was hurting so bad, and the blood coming out of my ears, nose, and mouth. And I started crawling for the house. And I had about 200 feet to make it to the house. My wife was at work. I finally got to the garage door, and it was level with ground level, and I could get that door open. Well, then when I tried to make it up into the house, I had to take a step up to go into the kitchen. That door went into the kitchen, and we had one on the back door. I knew I couldn't get to the back door. So I crawled up there and got that door open, but kind of leaning on it. But my sternum was busted all the way down, and my neck was, had vertebrae broken, my neck and my back and my ribs. And I couldn't turn over. I tried to push my elbow. I fell in face first on the kitchen floor. And I tried to turn over to get so I could crawl up to the phone. The phone was on the countertop there, and I couldn't get turned over because every time I'd push my elbow into the floor to turn over, that it'd separate my sternum there, and it just, there's so much pain, I couldn't stand it. And I was bleeding really bad. So I just, to keep from the blood going down and drowning me in my own blood, I just turned my head and let it bleed on the floor. And my wife come home about 3 hours after that, and here's a big puddle of blood on the floor and me laying there. She about had a heart attack. I couldn't talk very loud, so she said, "I'll call an ambulance." I said, no, I'm going to die, I think, so I want to die right here at home. And so she got me up in a chair and tied towels around me to keep me in the chair because I couldn't really sit there the way I was busted up. And she just, my chin was down on my chest because my neck was broke. And she lift my head up and pour hot broth and soup and tea down me. And it was Martin Luther King on a day on Monday. So she had Monday off. And she said, "Well, I'm going to," and this happened on Friday, Friday about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And, so I thought, well, I'm still alive on Monday. So I had her go ahead and take me into the hospital. But, and of course, you know how doctors are, especially orthopedic doctors in emergency. "Well, why didn't you get in here on Friday?" Well, I couldn't. I thought I was going to die. And I was letting her speak for me because I couldn't talk as loud, much above a whisper. But anyway, my wife's pretty tolerant. She's went through an awful lot with me over the years of getting busted on horses and having broken legs, broken arms, and whatever, you know, that you get from dealing with the type of horses that I've dealt with for the last 65 years, you know. And so, and I say 65 because I didn't do much of that in my younger years because I spent a lot of time in the service. But anyway, Wes, that's kind of the story on that one, and I hope I didn't leave out any of the really good detailed stuff.
No,
it was kind of a...
It's a terrible story, and you should have gone to the hospital, Bob, instead of dying with your cowboy boots on. But I'll tell you, Russell, so we're at Beachfoot, and Bob's telling this story to Shane and my brother Woody. And he was telling him, hey, after I think it was like a year or two, Bob could hold up a glass of water, and he was kind of showing them, hey, I can actually hold up a glass of water. And like a numbnuts, I walk up and I'm like, "Hey, Bob, how you doing? You SOB, how are you?" And I'm slapping him on the shoulder. I'm like, "You're looking good. You're looking real good, old man. You're looking great." And I'm just slapping him on the shoulder. And I look over at Woody and Shane, and their mouths are dropped open. And every time I slap Bob on the shoulder, I see this glass of water is getting lower and lower and lower. And Bob's not saying anything. He's not like, "Hey, idiot, stop slapping me on the shoulder." And the whole time I'm like, "Good to see you. Good to see you. How are you doing? You SOB, you tough SOB, how are you?" And and then Bob walked off, and Shane and Woody had told me this story, and my heart sank. I was like, "Oh my God!" I felt so terrible that whole trip. I think I apologized to you 100 times, but I felt so terrible.
Well, you did, Wes.
Yeah, but
it was good to see you. So I figured what pain I got out of that was well worth it.
Well, what's funny? I'm listening to this story, and I'm picturing you doing that. And I don't know how many people know the size that you are, Wes, but you're a big stout boy. And I've met you, shook your hands, you've slapped me on the shoulder, and you don't do it like a little petite girl. You have a good solid manly handshake and pat on the back, and I can just picture this.
Yeah. Hey, Wes, I was just hoping you didn't pat me one more time. but I wasn't going to say anything because it's sure good to see you, you know.
Good thing you didn't go up and do the old chest bump thing, you know.
Oh, my God. I would have fell over backwards and probably died in my boots, you know.
What did I tell you, though? Is this not the cowboy version of Evel Knievel?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And Bob has so many of those stories. And if people, when they go to the International Bigfoot Conference and you get a chance to meet Bob, which – Bob's, I mean, I can't say enough good things about Bob, but if you get a chance to meet Bob,
thank you, Wes.
Outside of Bigfoot, ask him about, you know, his rodeo days. Ask him about, you know, go outside of Bigfoot. And Bob, your eyes light up. You have a true love of horses. You have a true love of the rodeo. You have a true love of, and I love talking to you because your eyes light up and you start talking about horses and you start talking about all these. And you told many stories of that wasn't a one-off situation. I know you've been broken down before with whether it be the rodeo or with horses. And I would have given up the horses. I'd been like, I'll just keep dogs, get rid of these horses after something like that. I would have been done with them.
Well, he'd have got bit. I should have. But, you know, Wes, let me just tell you a little story about a really good friend of mine. In fact, we became friends and rode together for the next 10, 12 years. I went to work for an outfit called Derek Freight Lines, and there was a young guy there about 23, 24 years old. He walked up to me and he says, "Sure, a pleasure to meet you, Bob." He said, "My dad was in the sheriff's posse with you." But he said, "I never really got a chance to meet you." And he said, "I've heard some kind of wild stories about you." And I said, "Well, like what?" And he said, "Well, the way you ride in the mountains and the way you do things." And I said, "Well, I don't do anything any different than what I want to do." And he said, "Well, you go some really dangerous places." I said, "No, I don't go any place that's dangerous. I just go where I want to go. And if it appears to be dangerous to somebody else," I said, "then that's their take on it. I don't think it's dangerous or wouldn't go there. I'm not that stupid." So he said, "Well, he said, "You know the mountains really well and the trails really well, don't you?" And I said, "Well, I'm up there a lot." And he said, "You mind if I go with you next weekend?" And I said, "No, I don't mind. I'd like to have you along for company." Because I said, he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I haven't made up my mind yet. I'm just going to get up there and ride where I want to go. I'm going to go." So we was up on a place called Section 3. And it was pretty steep. It was a kind of a trail that the horse people used to ride on. And I said, "I'm going over there to McNeil, the mountain over there." And he said, "Well, you can't get there from here." I said, "What do you mean I can't get there from here?" I said, "I'm going to get there from here." He said, "That's going to be another half day's ride all the way around." I said, "Oh, no, 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 no. That's going to be half a day's ride." So I just said, "Well, I'm going." And I bailed off the hill with my horse. And his back legs were sliding up underneath his nose going down the side of the mountain there. And it was pretty steep. He thought it was really steep. And I didn't know whether he was going to come with me or not come with me. So I just went on, and I didn't even look back to see if he was behind me. I got down there, and I stopped at the bottom, and then I was going to start on over. And I heard something coming, and it was my friend. And he got down there. And back in those days, you know, whiskey... They had that gal, that real sexy-looking gal in Black Velvet. You guys are probably too young to remember Black Velvet. But anyway, that was the cowboy whiskey back then before Pendleton came out. And Gordy opened his saddlebag and pulled a fifth of Black Velvet out, and he said, "You want a snort of that?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, might as well." So I took a drink, and he took a drink, and he looked at me, and he kind of grinned, and he said, "All those stories I heard about you is true." And I said, "Well, I don't know what stories you've heard about me," but I said, he said, "Ain't nobody in their right mind would come off this hill like you came off." And I said, "Well, I didn't say I was in the right mind. I just said I go where I want to go." and he said, "You know something?" He said, "I was scared to death. to go off there, but he said, I seen you going off that hill. So he said, I just came behind you. And he said, by golly, I ain't scared of nothing now. And so he said, I'll ride with you as long as you ever want me to. So he had children that was in the 4-H, him and his wife were 4-H leaders. So we did things with the kids and the 4-H fathers. And we had a centennial, 1976 centennial ride that was even more daring than that. Started out with 12 guys, ended up with 10. Some of them just couldn't take the pressure. And anyway, we had a white shirt and tie down in the little Hindus. And I came off Rattlesnake Peaks right down into the little Hindus. And they had to have a white shirt and tie on to have dinner there. And Gordy was a good cook, so he cooked up a big old meal. We had champagne. We had roasted corn. We had salad. We had everything. Because we'd hauled it in the saddlebags with dry ice in the, in the pack outfits with dry ice in there to keep everything cool enough. So, and we were out for 3 days. I think it was a Labor Day weekend. I'm not sure, but it was one of those deals. And it was a Washington Centennial, 1976. And so we was going to make a special ride out of that, a centennial ride, and we did. And we started out with 12 4-H fathers, and by the time we got down into the little Hindus, they'd either quit or couldn't have it. They didn't have enough nerve to ride where we were going. And when I bailed off the hill, they said, he'll never make it to the bottom alive. Well, I got down to the bottom, waited for the rest of them to come down. And I took a pack horse down, and I had Gordy's wife's Crystal in my pack, in my stuff on the pack horse. And by stopping, running the horses into trees to slow them down, I broke one piece of Crystal with a pack horse. And so that was almost a record in itself, you know, as to not break up stuff. But we had it packed pretty good in there. But anyway, that's the story on that one. I just wanted to share that with you, Wes, because that was one for the records.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. What was involved with being part of the Sheriff's Posse? I mean, what kind of tasks were you assigned?
Well, the Sheriff's Posse, I was in search and rescue. One of the things that we did a lot of, and we had a state convention every year, and you competed in all kinds of events like trailer race, chariot race, flat races, and of course I was only in the racing part of it. And there was pistol shooting, you know, because I was also a reserve deputy at that time. I had a commission from the sheriff as regular deputies, but I didn't want to work like that. I wanted to work on the kind of jobs I was, you know. But anyway, I went to the academy and got a commission like a regular deputy, so that if they needed us for backup, for arrest insurance or anything like that, I was qualified and would be the county of Yakima County would be behind me as far as arrest insurance or anything like that. Any kind of litigation would happen to come up about it. And we did parking at the fairs, and I did pick up money at the booth to take to the office. But we were the only posse in the state of Washington that had the same equipment as a regular deputy. We had handguns that we used, same as a regular deputy. None of the other posses had regular handguns, loaded handguns in their holsters, and we were allowed to have that because we were the first posse in the state of Washington that was put together by a sheriff by the name of Burt Guns. And all that was to do is to assist the regular deputies if they needed it, or to stand a special guard detail for some kind of function that was happening. Like we had celebrities come here for the fair. Well, then that was our job, is to be around the celebrities and protect them. That gave me an opportunity to meet a lot of celebrities and be in backstage with some of them at some times, like John Cash and June and Helen Reddy and Barbara Mandrell, and the list goes on and on and on, of Ken Curtis and Bess Parker and Waylon Jennings, and, you know, whatever celebrities they had come to the fair. So that was our job, to protect or be around them so people wouldn't torment the heck out of them. But so the sheriff's posse covered a lot of fields, and like we had a state convention every year, and it was held in different cities. And of course, we competed against each other, like in Ellensburg Rodeo, which is a had a great little rodeo up there. They had a little hill there that on top of this hill was a water tower, and they had the ceremony of the Indians riding off the hill, because the Indians used to ride off that hill in the early days and meet the white men down in there to do their trading down by the creek. So the Ellensburg Rodeo Posse, I was doing a lot of flat racing, Pony Express racing, baton racing, and things, anything that had speed and things like that, and I was in the middle of it all the time. So they come to me and they said, well, Bob, we need a little more excitement. Would you mind running off that hill, racing off that hill with the group? And I said, not at all. I said, you know, I ride off steeper places than that every day. So some of the guys said, no, that's too steep. They wouldn't ride a horse running wide open off the top of a hill like that. And I said, well, that's not a problem. So we started that race. The other posses, of course, the guys that had enough nerve to run it, went ahead, and we competed on that race. Well, I always did quite well on that race, and sometimes, most of the time, I won it. But the sad part of it is, you know, there was injuries there. And possibility of injuries, I'll put it that way. So there was one guy wanted to ride that race, and he couldn't ride a horse worth a hoot. And I knew he couldn't ride a horse. I knew he couldn't ride a horse up that hill. Well, I had to go home and bale hay on Monday on Labor Day. I put a guy in charge, the lieutenant in charge, and this guy talked him into riding that race. Well, I always made sure that I had a cinch my saddle up good and had a breast collar on the horse, and I'd sit down at the bottom and wait until they get ready. And sometimes I'd even walk the horse up the hill and back around the cones that they had on top of the hill and back down. And most of the guys would go with me that was going to race against me. Well, this particular guy just sat down there. They said I wasn't there. And he didn't get off and tighten his cinch or anything. And I don't even know why they let him run, but they did. And they had swung a 16-foot Powder River gate around the track where I used to race these horses around the track. And he borrowed a horse that I had been racing around the track. And when he started out with that horse, he started everybody started up the hill, and he tried to guide the horse up the hill. And he couldn't get it to go, and the saddle slipped sideways, and he hit the Powder River gate right in his chest, and it drove a rib straight through his heart and killed him instantly.
Oh, geez.
So they called me and told me about it, and I said, geez, why did you guys let him ride that race? Are you out of your minds? And the guy was married and had a family, and so then we did as all we could for his family. And so then they called me, and they said, well, Bob, there are so many people that just held their breath when he hit that gate and he smacked so hard. He said it just brought the rodeo to a dead stop. And they said, would you suggest that we don't run that race anymore? And I said, hell no. Are you guys crazy? I said, I started that race. I said, if a man got killed on a bull out there, would you stop bull riding? Oh, no, we couldn't do that. I said, well, then you're not going to stop that hill race, because I'm going to be running that hill race till I get too damn old to ride. And so I went ahead and run that hill race for about 4 more years or so. And then it was getting to the point where it was getting to be hard to get enough guys that had enough nerve to ride it. So they slowed down with it, and then I got injured real bad and was out of riding commission for a year. And I don't know which time it was. It might have been the time that I was telling you about the 3 days that I sat there. One of them times, anyway, that I was in pretty bad shape. So they didn't run it that year because I wasn't there to push the thing going. And then they just quit it altogether. And now then they don't even do anything like they did back when I was pushing stuff, because I promoted a race from Ellsberg to Selah through the mountains, through the Sagebrush Hills, a 25-mile race. And that was tough on horses, tough on men. But anyway, that was another story, you know, about that. That was a kind of a wild story. But it worked out good. And this was like five different posses come to enter the race. And of course, there's five guys running at one time. And most of the distances were between a mile and 2 miles to run. And that's through the Sagebrush Mountains there. And some of it pretty rough, across the creek and around some down steep gullies and up and things. But, you know, I lived and breathed those challenges back then, and I liked it. And the guys that weren't able to do it, then they just didn't do it. You know, and then I'd always recruit the ones that had enough nerve or to ride that kind of stuff. And so for quite a few years, I was really having a good time doing that, because I Pony Express race all the time, chariot raced, and trailer raced. And one time they brought a llama on the field, spooked the horse that I was trying to get the head stall on, and he took off running around the track, and I wrapped both arms around his neck and hung on, and him running wide open and my feet out in the way, and they kept hollering, "Let go." Well, he was running so fast, if I'd have let go, he'd have run over the top of me. And I rode him all the way around the track into the backside at a place called Walla Walla until he finally tired out with my weight up on top of his neck and just quit running. So, you know, I just used to do things like that, Wes, and wasn't that I was trying to prove anything. It was just that that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, I would imagine you would have to have a love for horses and a passion for that, because, you know, I think of like the Bluff Creek incident. When you guys were, you and Roger rode in, or when you go up in these back hills, you know, you get bucked off a horse or your horse gets spooked and you get injured, you're in bed with it at that point. There's really no help that's going to come anytime soon. And so I would imagine you kind of have to trust your horse in those situations.
Well, yeah, I had two big horses up there one time, and the one that I didn't think would jump on me when we jumped across the creek, he jumped on me and broke my leg. And so I went down and talked to some people who was in the tent, woke them up, got them out of the tent, and I got them, and they got me a stick to walk with, and got them down to where my packs and stuff were, and asked them if they could put them on for me. And they finally got the packs and stuff on for me, and I rode out that 7 or 8 miles and got down there, and I was sitting on my horse, and some people drove up, man and woman drove up in a pickup. And I said, "Have you folks got any aspirins?" And they said, "Yeah, why?" And I said, "Well, I got a broken leg." And the lady said, "You got a broken leg, and I'm still sitting on the horse." And she told her husband, "You get over there and help him." And he come over. He wanted to go fishing, so he wasn't too much interested in an old cowboy with a broken leg. So I had a Ford pickup with an automatic in it, and he loaded my horses for me, and I got in that pickup. And the woman said, "We're going to follow you to the hospital." And I said, "No, just follow me out to the highway, the main highway. I'll be okay if I can get out there." And she said, "Well, you must have a lot of pain." I said, "Well, yes, I have a lot of pain, but I'm not going to just stay up here. I'm going into the hospital." So, you know, I drove into Yakima to the emergency, and I went hopping in there with a stick that I had broken for me to get off and on the horse with, and told them what was wrong, and they said, "You got to move that trailer with them horses in it out there." And I said, "Well, call my buddy to come and do it, because you're going in to have a cast put on your leg." I said, yeah, okay, makes sense to me. So, you know, things like that, Wes, you got to do what you got to do at the time you do it. There, whatever happens to you, you got to do it. You know, you don't sit around and say, "Hey, I'm waiting for somebody to come and help me," you know.
Yeah.
No, so did they meet you at the hospital?
Did they what?
Did they meet you at the hospital and say, "Your usual room, Mr. Gimlin," because you've been in and out of there so many times?
Well, one time I went in there with the horse and kicked me in the back of the head, pulling logs down, and I took the back of my scalp off. And I was, and it was cold. It was 10 below zero up where it was the elk camp. And then by the time I got down to the hospital, it was like 45 miles down, riding in the pickup. My head warmed up enough that started bleeding again. So when I went into the hospital, they told me to go in this little room and wait. The nurse stuck her head around the corner and says, "Hi, Bob, what are you doing here?" I said, "A horse kicked me in the back of the head." She, I said, "How did you know I was here?" She said, "I followed a blood trail, and I know it's elk season." And she said, "They just said some cowboy coming in here with the back of his head kicked off." And she said, "I knew it had to be you." And so she said, "I just come in here to talk to you."
Yeah, that's amazing. Anyway, you know, you got to really love it to I would imagine. Yeah, because if you didn't, you know, any other person, I think one injury, they would be done. But you would imagine you have to have love for the horses. You have to have love for that lifestyle, because if you don't have passion for it, you'd quit.
Well, absolutely, Wes. You know, and it goes on and on and on. The last time was 2 years ago, and my wife's kind of bossy at times, and I was hurt pretty bad. Took my left bicep out, my left shoulder, and tendon stuff out of my neck, and a mule slammed me really hard in the round pen again. And she said, "Mr. Bob, there's going to be some new rules around this old cowboy camp." She said, "You take any more of these people's bronky outside horses, you just turn your key in and find you another place to live." And I said, "Yeah, I kind of like living here, so I haven't took any outside horses now for 2 years."
Yeah, that's a good woman, man. You got to keep her, Bob. You know, she's
pretty bossy at times. I've been together with her for 53 years, and she's put up with an awful lot of broken bones and stuff, and hauled my sorry ass to the hospital, and you know, and did my chores for me when I wasn't able to carry bales of hay or you know, carry buckets of water or whatever. Because you know, my horse population varied at different times, horses and mules, because I did lots of packing. I actually packed. Did some contracts for the Forest Service and packed mules. Then I packed, helped buddies get into elk camps and stuff, packing in. And, you know, I liked it and I did it. And it's just one of those things that a guy does. You know, you don't sit around all day and say, "I wish I'd do this and I wish I'd do that." I was injured pretty bad in 72 with a horse rolling down the mountain on me and tore me up pretty bad, and I got patched up the best I could with the best orthopedic doctors I had here at the time, and by 1978 I was having trouble with my shoulders and bones and stuff that was busted, but I was using a hand truck hauling freight for a company, and so I asked them for a leave of absence, and I kind of planned on this. And I took a pack mule and a saddle horse and had my father-in-law haul me down in California right at the Mexican border. And I rode 3.5 months coming west, coming back to the state of Washington through some, you know, unpleasant events. Met a lot of good people that helped me a lot in the desert, in the Mojave Desert, and even up through the mountains. And it was a great summer. I lost a lot of mass off my body from that trip, but I guess I didn't need it or wouldn't have lost it to start with. And it was just a matter where I was down in such poor looking shape, and my wife and my father-in-law come to pick me up and bring some more horses, and I sat on a big old rock alongside the road where I knew they were coming in, and they just waved at me and went right on past, and I waved at them and they waved at me and just went right on past. So where I told them I'd meet them was down there about 150 yards by this little lake. So I walked down there and I said, "Looked," and they looked at me when I walked up like a deer in the headlights. And I said, "Why didn't you guys stop?" And they said, "We didn't recognize you." Well, I was black from going without my shirt, and I had a big old scar along my belly from the mule pulling back and rope burned me, and my hair was about 12 inches long down over my shoulders, and I'd lost 55 pounds or more. They just said, "Well, you look like a prisoner of war just come out of prison camp. You was so skinny and looked so mad." Uh-oh. Somebody recognizes me out here. I don't know who it is, but maybe they recognize Russ.
Well, I think you're going to live forever, Bob. And 53 years of marriage, it's too late to get out now, you know?
Well, hey, Wes, it's been a great one to talk to you this morning. And by golly, sometime maybe you and I will sit down and visit some more. You know, Wes, I went through so many different things in life and experiences. But, you know, I'm old, so I had a lot of time to do that, you know, and things that Roger Patterson and I talked about. What did she want, Wes?
Oh, she... we're sitting in the Bigfoot truck for the International Bigfoot Conference, and this gal pulls up and wanted to talk to Bob and see if you were on the hunt for Bigfoot and had some information, but she said she'll come back later.
Well, that's nice. Thank you. Thank you, young lady.
Well, you know, and I want to get to the International Bigfoot Conference. Bob, I appreciate you sharing the stories. You know, I love even non-Bigfoot stories. I love to hear them, and I know you've lived a long, full life, and like I said, I think after all the injuries and everything, you'll probably outlive me. But I want to talk about the International Bigfoot Conference. And, you know, Bob, one thing I've always appreciated of you is after 50 years of this film, you know, I think and you don't have to answer this, but I think I'd get burnt out on talking about it. But you're always gracious to people who come up and talk to you guys, you know, who talk to you, Bob. You're always gracious and you always answer questions. And I'm sure you've answered the questions a million times over and over and over again. But you're very gracious with people. Tell us about the International Bigfoot Conference.
Well, hey, it's a great conference. And anybody that hasn't been there, I'd sure like to see them show up this year or anytime this year or next year and the years after that. Because Russell does a great job on that down there, and he's always got some really good speakers, the very cream of the crop as far as I'm concerned. And if he could get John down there, John Vandernackel, again, I don't know if John's been down there before, but if the missus feels able to, if John isn't able to drive, if the missus is able to drive him down there, hey, I'll tell you, if you can hear John speak, but I'll tell you, folks, the place is really a great place to be. And Russ does a great job. I'm proud to be able to go down there and be part of that. Well, I won't really be part of it, but I'll just come down and do whatever I can. And Wes, one of the reasons that I tried to be as nice to people or whatever you want to call it, you know, I believe in treating other folks like I'd like to be treated myself. And I've been treated most of the time really fair and well. And there was a few years I had some bad years, but that's gone. That's way back of me now. I don't keep on thinking about bad things. I think about all the good people that I meet and visit with and have a chance to talk to, as yourself, Wes, and Russell. And the list goes on and on and on and on. I couldn't even mention a tenth of the names of the wonderful people. And I keep telling folks at all the conferences, you know, I never made much money like that was made by Roger and Al the Atlee. But I said, I'm richer by far than either one of them. One's dead and the other isn't. But by meeting all the wonderful people that I've met over the years at the conferences and had friendly relations with them, and, you know, I learned early in life, treat people just exactly like you like to be treated. And that's why it's not only effort to treat people good. It's just it's easier than being surly and nasty about it. But and the Lord put us here to be brothers and sisters in this world, not to be arguing and fighting and disagreeing. If there's somebody disagrees with me, I'll say, well, that's your opinion. I've got a little different one, but that doesn't want to make us go to Fifth City or anything like that or be not speak to each other. Hey, if we got a difference, that's what makes things work is differences, you know. And so that's kind of the way I feel about it, Wes.
No, I appreciate that. And Russell, tell us a little bit about the conference. What can people expect when they show up?
Okay. Well, the conference is going to be held in Kennewick, Washington over Labor Day weekend. That would be September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. The venue we have picked out is the Three Rivers Convention Center, and it's right there, pretty easy to find. It's close to the, right next to the Toyota Center, so it's a pretty easy place to find. The speakers we have lined up, we have Dr. Jeff Meldrum, we have Adam Davis, we have Mark Marcel, we've got David Floyd, David Ellis, Derek Randall's from the Olympic Project, and the list goes on. We've got a heck of a lineup. But we also have a lot of the locals and people from far out that are bringing, setting up for vendor tables so that you guys have a lot of really cool, interesting things to pick through while you're there. But it's a chance to celebrate a 50-year anniversary of a film that really set things into motion on Bigfoot research and reality as far as it goes. It is still the most controversial piece of film to date, and the largest piece of evidence that we've ever come across, the film that was filmed in 1967 by Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin. And to have Bob come to this conference and be able to meet and greet and shake hands with and that sort of thing, the guests that come there, is just a great honor. Bob has not been to a whole lot of conferences this year. He's got a lot of things at home that he's taken care of and just slowing down a bit. So for him to agree to come to this thing was just a great gift. So anybody who has a chance to come and meet Bob, take that opportunity. This is an icon. This is 50 years of standing by it. You know, this guy is really got something to offer. So it's going to be a blast, Wes. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. And I know you're going to be there with your poker chips and cards. So yeah. I look forward to that.
Yeah, and Woody will be there. Yeah. Woody's going to come with me. And I'm just looking forward to it. Woody. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys. And I know tickets are selling out for the audience. Go to the International Bigfoot Conference. Click on the tickets. Get your tickets. And we'll have a blast out there. Like I said, last year was a blast. I'm sure it's going to be 100 times better this year, just with the speakers and then Bob. And I just can't wait. I've been counting down the days. I know it's September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in Kennewick, Washington. And get your tickets now, internationalbigfootconference.com. And I know you guys are sitting in a hot truck, and I appreciate you guys coming on, Russell and Bob. Thank you so much. And Bob, thank you for the stories, and I hope you guys have a great rest of the evening.
Thank you very much, Wes.
Thank you, Wes, and the International Bigfoot Conference down there. Folks, I'm just a tip of the iceberg. Those wonderful speakers that Russ has got lined up there, and I've always got to say something about Dr. Meldrum. If any of you that are coming the first time, and I sure hope there's a lot of you coming, if you listen to Dr. Meldrum speak, not just picking out Dr. Meldrum, they're all great speakers, but if you've never heard Dr. Meldrum speak, it's worth making a long trip to just hear him speak. This man is incredible, and the rest of them will be too, but Dr. Meldrum is worth going a long distance just to hear him speak. He's very knowledgeable. He's been in it for a long, long time. And he was one of Dr. Grover Krantz's, if you know who I'm talking about, Dr. Grover Krantz.
Oh, yeah.
Over at Pullman, Washington. Dr. Meldrum started out as one of Dr. Krantz's students at one time. Thank you very much, Wes. Hope to see you down at the International Bigfoot Conference.
Thanks, fellas.
Thanks, Wes.
And that's it for tonight, everyone. Remember, if you've had an encounter, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. It was kind of fun to talk to Bob outside of Bigfoot. Just talk to him about his life, my little tribute to him. If you get a chance, go to the internationalbigfootconference.com. Get your tickets. Bob will be out there. I'll be out there. Not that that's relevant to anyone. But Russell, all the great speakers, definitely come and hang out with us. Hang out with a bunch of outlaws, renegades, and an old cowboy that's probably going to live forever. Until next time, everyone.